Welcome to Golf Origin Stories. I'm Chris McEwen, and that is Led Zeppelin. Yeah, that's right. Kicking things off with some Zeppelin off of their first ever album, Led Zeppelin 1. That's Good Times, Bad Times. It's Zeppelin, man, Zeppelin. I think about on January 11th, 1969, no one knew about Led Zeppelin. And when I listen to this album, I think about that. Like, it was like there is a timestamp in the musical world where Led Zeppelin didn't exist. And then January 12th, 1969, Led Zeppelin 1 drops. It is released in the United States. And just imagine for a moment hearing something like that for the first time. I mean, that, and I get it. Like, we all kind of listened or heard Led Zeppelin for the first time, but like not for the first time. I mean, it was like, and from that point on, rock and roll would never, ever be the same. That was, you talk about changing the dynamic of music forever. That album, this song, did exactly that. And the really interesting thing is when they released Zeppelin 1, Jimmy Page wasn't real big into releasing singles. And he thought most of the songs on this record didn't really lend themselves to radio play, which is like today just unfathomable, right? I mean, between, you know, just releasing singles in general, but then listening to Led Zeppelin and thinking they wouldn't be on the radio is crazy. That doesn't make any sense because they're always on the radio. But they did finally talk him into releasing one song, and it was Good Times, Bad Times. Now, eventually they would release Communication Breakdown too off the same record. But yeah, this was the one that changed everything. And it's, I mean, what a perfect way to introduce yourself. I mean, you've got Jimmy Page with that powerful guitar riff. You've got John Bonham just kind of playing around with that hi-hat and then thumping the bass drum, and then off we go. And and Led Zeppelin exists. It's just crazy. So this album has just been recently top of mind as it was. So it was good to throw it out. Plus, I couldn't believe I hadn't used a Led Zeppelin song. We're like, whatever it is, I don't know how many episodes I've done of this show, and to play a Zeppelin song, shame on me. But I play it with one on Twitter, a former guest and good pal of mine, Cal Stovey, asked me to give him five albums pre-2000, full albums that would be good, sort of inspirational golf albums, sort of to either get you in the mood or had some good rhythms to it or a good flow to it, or whatever it was. He didn't really give me any sort of, he just said, what are five good pre-2000 albums that I should listen to before golf, while playing golf, whatever. And this is one of them. And so if you want to see the full list, you can head to Twitter at Chris McEwen, and you can follow me on there. And this was the first one that I used this, as I said, as the demarcation point for modern rock. Led Zeppelin 1, boom, everything else changes from there. We move forward. But this, I mean, if you want to go and, you know, listen to something on the golf course, I don't think you can go wrong with a little Led Zeppelin 1 for about 45 minutes. Should get you through a couple holes. Anyways, welcome to the show, everybody. There's another reason that I picked Led Zeppelin. I'll get into that in a second. Of course, I reference it in the episode because why not? Welcome to Masters Week. I feel like the golf season is officially kicking off with the Masters, especially here in the Midwest. The weather is changing. It was 70 degrees over this past weekend. You know, had some really great golf over this past weekend. Jordan Spieth got a win, which is great. The ANA Inspirational Women's Tournament was amazing. We had the Augusta National Women's Amateur, which is great to watch. just a lot of, and the Cubs are back on television playing baseball, and they took the series from the Pirates. So all in all, I would say things are looking up, right? Think so. Anyways, hope everyone is well. Thank you for joining the show. If you're new here, this is a golf podcast, I promise you, but I'm a music psycho and I listen to a lot of music. And so I open every episode with a different song. And if you like what you hear, if you like the style of the show, subscribe or tell a friend, just stick around, rate the show, leave a review, those kinds of things, those kind of podcasty things. My guest, let's get into the golf. My guest is, you may know the name, if you're a golfer, David Adell. He owns this little golf company called Adell Golf. And, we talk about, they've just come out with a new wedge. And on the surface, you think, okay, cool, new wedge. All right. But this is the other reason I used Led Zeppelin to open the show. I mentioned that Zeppelin 1 is a timestamp within history of music. From that point on, you're going to start hearing Led Zeppelin in all kinds of different bands, right? You listen to Soundgarden, you hear Led Zeppelin. You listen to Pearl Jam, you hear Led Zeppelin. It's just pick a band, pick a rock band, and if it's a two guitar band, it's probably borrowing some things from Led Zeppelin. You know, the Zeppelin was just basically a blues rock band, right? They just happened to do things a little differently than the previous sort of blues style. You know, the Who even were influenced. Lots of influences. Anyways, the point is, this wedge, it's called the SMS wedge, may be a timestamp in the pantheon of golf equipment moving forward. There may be, 10, 20 years down the road when everyone's doing what Adell Golf has just implemented into their wedges, we're going to look back and be like, yeah, that's when that happened. Like right now, we're living in it right now. They released a wedge that will go on to become a milestone in golf design. That's how significant I legitimately and genuinely think this new wedge is. It's something. It is really something. And it's a really, besides talking about the wedge, which we clearly will do in this episode, David Adell is amazing. The man is brilliant. He has a mind that very few, I think, in the golf world, let alone, anyone I know has. Like, just the way that he thinks about things and the way he's using data, the way he's using, body mechanics and things like that to design this kind of equipment for us is different, and it's significant. And so we talk about that. We talk about kind of the company itself. We talk about his background in golf. It goes way back. Really fun conversation. But we kick things off just kind of randomly as we were chatting up and getting ready for the show. I just happened to hit record as we were in mid-conversation because he kind of dropped a name that I had to ask about. I had to follow about. So let's get into the conversation with David Adell. And I hope you enjoy it. Did you really? Is Bill Murray as crazy as he seems?
Oh, he's like, pretty laid back. I mean,
yeah, okay.
I've been around him several times, and he'll randomly say something really funny, and then he's just a normal guy, He's
right. He's like, to him, he's just him. He's
yeah,
not Bill Murray.
He doesn't run around acting like he's in the movie Stripes or Meatballs or anything like that.
Even with I imagine without fans, like when he does the pro-am stuff, he just like actually plays golf, and he doesn't.
Yeah,
no. Screw around the entire.
He loves the game. We played Demon's Hall in Charleston. It was awesome. Seth Rayner.
Yeah.
A lot of fun.
Okay, so just real quick, and we'll get into the rest of the stuff. How did you meet and become friends with Bill Murray?
So Billy Getty from the Getty family.
Okay.
So I was over doing a teaching thing with Billy. He would bring in all these biomechanists and like Mike Adams and Terry Rawls and all these guys. And we would sit around for 4 days and just 5 days talk about golf and, you know, work on projects. And I'm standing in the kitchen and the first day I get there and all of a sudden I'm like, what the fuck? I'm like, goddamn, Bill Murray standing in front of me. And I thought he was a neighbor, you know, we were at Kukio in Hawaii. And I find out Bill Murray's staying with us for 5 days. So
shut up.
Yeah, I hung out with Bill Murray for 5 days. It was awesome. And then wow. I fit him, and then he played my stuff in the AT&T the year before last, last year. And then this year, I sent him a new putter, and then I went out to Charleston and hung out with him. And so, yeah, it was pretty cool. So he's that.
Yeah. That's a good segue into your, as of this, we're a day before official launch, right? But when this podcast drops, it'll be out.
Yeah.
Right. Your new SMS wedge, that kind of like, what do you have? 4 different grinds or something like that on it. And, this, so there's, I talk about music on this show because I like music. And, I was just talking about sometimes, a band or an artist will put out a record or put out a song, and it's kind of like a stamp, like a moment in time where now everything's going to be different within that genre, within that, you know, whatever, within music. I kind of feel like, I don't know about you. Well, maybe you, I'm sure you feel this way, but the whole weight system in a wedge, like this is a timestamp in the golf equipment design, you know, timeline.
Yeah. It's going to change the way people articulate mass in a golf club, forever.
Yeah.
You know, we're not going to talk about it as a collision force anymore. We're going to talk about it as a rotational steering force. And it's going to be pervasive through, you know, club fitting instruction. I mean, when you can change someone's path 5 degrees just by changing the weight in a golf club, you know, and, you know, why people do what they do. I mean, we were always talking about instruction and then we talk about the golf club, but we never really tie that stuff together other than just making sure they get the right lie and the right shaft and, you know,
right,
buy heads that they like and they like to look at and try to find performance. But when you can appreciably change flight characteristics, path, all that stuff, spin rates, all that through changing weight. I mean, 4 out of the 20 people we did an intense study on, needed the weight in the middle of the golf club. That means 16 needed it. Over 75% needed it somewhere else.
Yeah.
And it's beyond transformative. I mean, it was one of those mistakes that I made trying to do a prototype that then turned into a movement.
Really? This was like kind of an accident? Was this like the 3M post-it story where you were
kind of it's kind of like, you know, they're like, well, this machine's spitting out the wrong foam. And next thing you know, it's, you end up using it in boxes, right? You know,
right.
It becomes the peanuts that we hate. But yeah, it kind of was that, you know, I Mike Adams, my very good buddy, he always talked about, oh, you port the wedge, that raises the CG, drops the flight down and keeps spin. And so I was working on, you know, what can we do new in wedges that would, you know, be transformative. And I thought, well, maybe I'll make a vertical CG system that I can control vertical.
Ah.
So I ported a wedge, just, you know, when I make prototypes, I'll just bang something out to vet the concept rather than get, you know, make it into a big project. And so I ported 3 deep holes in the bottom of the, in the back of the flange, that went almost to the face. And then I put a ton of lead tape on top thinking, okay, I'm going to knock the ball flight down. And I did the exact opposite. Yeah. It spun more, went more right. And I went, what? And then I peeled the lead tape off, rolled it into a tube, weighed about 8 grams, and I shoved it in one of the holes. And then I started hitting golf shots with it. And immediately everything felt different, you know, and I put it in the heel and I hit it way, way better. And then I put it in the middle of the club, not so good. And then in the toe, it was terrible. I hit it right and spun it more and it went higher. And then it kind of harkened back to, you know, I'd fit people for wedges and we had RCG farther out than almost anybody in the industry at the time. We kind of pioneered the talk of CG back then. All the Volkis had their CG a lot closer to the heel, longer hosels. And subsequently people would say, why am I hitting your wedge 8 yards shorter? And I'm like, I don't know. We measure the loft, the shafts were the same. Everything was the same.
Yeah.
Had gram weight of the head was the same. And I'm like, I have no idea. Well, that player that needed weight in the heel had more CG out towards the toe and it created a higher launch and spin and lost the distance. And I started, you know, going, whoa. And then I started thinking about, you know, all my past experience club fitting. And I went, holy crap, this is important. And then I put the weight in the toe on my son. He's a cover golfer, meaning his grip is on top and he's really steeper. I put it in the toe and he hit 5 shanks. And I went, it feels like the handle's going up and the head's going down. And I went, yeah, that's what I felt. And then I put it in the heel and he peered it. And then I designed a wedge that we could move the weight around. And we had removable weights going in toe, heel, and center. And started testing people, and that became huge. And then we went, this is something we got to do. So
when was that sort of happy mistake, happy accident? When did you actually start testing this stuff? Because I'm always fascinated to hear about that sort of production timeline from idea or discovery to, you know, what's, you know, the release.
It was probably in late April of last year.
Okay.
And then... You know, we tested it on a whole bunch of people and saw crazy results. And we went, okay, this is something we got to do. And then I hired an intern from Colorado School of Mines to do our programming. And so we came in for the summer and did all that. And then we went right to production, got our, you know, first samples. And then here we are. I mean, I had Heath Slocum in here 2.5 weeks ago. And put him through the fit. And, you know, we screen everybody to understand their biodynamics. And it helps us understand, you know, where someone will probably land. And Heath has a lot of scenarios in his personal biometrics that shallow him a lot. He's got a lot of external rotation in his shoulder where I don't have any. And I mean, he can go almost like 45 degrees back. He's an under golfer, so his fold pattern is under. He's got a strong grip. And most people that, apart from the external rotation, would probably have the weight fit in the toe. Well, he got so jammed up because it got lagged and laid off and that layback force jammed him up. He was hitting shanks. He goes, I haven't had a fucking jam. You know? And so then we put it in the heel and he just peered it. And he was just like, wow, this is a game changer. So it's so personal. And the neat thing about the wedge is that it's versatile. You know, it's not a, you know, we didn't make a layback wedge, a center wedge, and a heel wedge that you have to try to find the right one. You can, and so those characteristics of how the club rotates and that steering force changes angle of attack. If you're shallowing your plane 5 degrees, you're going to need a different grind. If you're steepening it, then you need a different grind. And so they kind of, so you fit for weight where it's going to be, then you fit for the grind, and then you fit for shaft. And it's a pretty amazing, seamless process.
That's unbelievable. How do you guys go about the fitting process? I know it will be available kind of at retailers and stuff. But I mean, I would imagine, well, one, do you have to go out and teach people how to fit for this new sort of different technology?
I mean, we have to educate. So, you know, that's where podcasts, that's where articles, that's where, you know, having people understand this stuff, that one, that they all have, when you measure someone, they go, I didn't know my lower arm was 2 inches longer than my upper arm. I didn't know it was a cover fold pattern. I didn't know I had external rotation like that, you know? And when people find out about what they are, then it starts to make sense and you can start making correlations. You know, if you measure, if you don't measure, you're just guessing, right? So, yeah, there'll be a little bit of a process. You know, I think, you know, the people will always default to a grind that they think they need rather than one that they truly need. So finding the right grind with the weight pattern might be the most tricky of all of it, just because if you shallow 5 degrees or you steepen a little bit, and, you know, we don't want to post our bounce numbers, but they're generally way higher than anybody in the industry because that's what people need. You know, you look at Tiger Woods, he's got a, his 56 is 23 degrees of bounce on it, you know, and everybody's out there buying 14 and 12 and 10, you know?
Yeah.
So, and then they wonder why they dig, you know, and, and depending on your turf conditions, you can always overbounce if you have wet soil and, you know, like where you're at, you have lush ground and we have clay and hard pan here. So, but yeah, it's really not that complicated. You know, I say that because I know it's so easy for me, but because you invented it's easy, but, but yeah, it's really self-evident when you go through the process because one setting works and the other two don't.
Yeah.
You know? And anybody can fit themselves and then, you know, they can go to like, if they were at a superstore or wherever and they hit shots off the mat with the right weight setting, then they just go, oh, this one feels so much better hitting the mat. You know, mats don't lie. You know, when you've thumped it behind it or you're digging it and when you just, when it just glides through mat, it's no different than turf. So, and anybody can use a diagnostic, you know, they can go to a superstore or find it, you know, scenario where they can take their launch and subtract it from their loft and then they know how much they took off the golf club. So if you launch a 60 degree wedge at 38, then you need 22 degrees of bounce. It's really not that hard, you know, and there's enough diagnostics out there that can help with that. So
that's, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
I didn't know that that's how that worked. That's fascinating. Yeah.
Golf
you can go anywhere now and do that stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. Anybody can go find out what their launch angle is with a golf club. I mean, you can just walk into any Golf Galaxy and hit some shots and know exactly what you need to do, you know? Or a superstore. So, you know, you don't have to own a $20,000 TrackMan to know that. So it's going to be something that, in my opinion, is probably one of the biggest things to hit the club and teaching industry. You know, telling people that are in the know in terms of, you know, equipment, telling people in the know in terms of instruction. And they're like, this is transformative.
Yeah.
And you put it in the hands of tour players or, you know, not so proficient golfers and they're just astounded, you know, like, wow, I had no idea how much this mattered. And you're like, well, you probably did. You probably said, well, I had a set of clubs that I used to hit really good. And then I got a new set and my game kind of fell apart and I thought it was me. And, you know, everybody blames me and they don't blame, you know, the process or the equipment. And
yeah,
it's the only thing between us and the ball. So, it's, really proud, you know, I stumbled on something again. But that's what happens when you think about this all day long and you're a teacher and you have the ability to make and tinker with things and you're always trying to do the right thing to make people a better golfer. And then you look at how different people are, right? We don't want to, there's no outliers in my philosophy. No one's an outlier.
Yeah.
Everybody's an individual. Everybody has the way they process shapes and weight and pressure. And your job as a fitter and a teacher is to make what they feel to be real and what they see to be real. Right. And taking their own scenarios into account, which is their body. Everybody's body's very different. Very seldom do you see anybody that has all the same characteristics, you know?
Right.
And so having a process, and that's why BioSwing Dynamics works so well with this, with Mike Adams and what Terry Rawls have been doing with BioSwing Dynamics is, you know, cracking the code to people. You know, I was a golf machine guy forever. I mean, I trained under Ben Doyle. I was one of his darlings. And I spent years with Ben at his side. And the book, you know, is a great book of classifications, but nowhere in the book does it tell you how to do anything. It doesn't tell you how to take these multiple, you know, 24 components with 3 to 11 variations and tell you what to configure, right? Bryce figured his own swing out of the golfing machine, and it made sense to him, and it matched his body type. That's why he can do that, what he does. And so what Mike Adams was able to do was basically, you know, categorize all these scenarios and then have an understanding of how to configure this for people, what they should do, why their grip should be strong, why their grip should be more neutral, how their arms, you know, the slot that they take the golf club back on, what slot do they bring it down on, what post do they work around, external rotation, you know, those kind of factors. And then you know exactly what to do to somebody without, you know, having to go through 30 years, 40 years of walking in the desert to figure out.
Right.
Right. So yeah, it's, so I just applied that scenario to the wedge process and said, okay, there's something, not everybody can swing the same golf. Why did Paul Azinger, you know, why was he playing ping I2s and he couldn't play blades? And why are other guys couldn't play I2s and they could play blades, you know?
Yeah.
And it really comes down to these steering forces and how their body works with a golf club. And we learned that at Henry Griffiths. We had offset irons and a non-offset iron, and people, they'd hit it right with the offset, and then you go, well, hand them the non, and they're, oh, I'm not good enough for that non-offset golf club. I'm not, you know, and they hit it pure and they're like, how's that? That's not the kind of golfer I am. I'm a hack, you know? And I'm like,
yeah,
no, you're, you know, that golf club created layback forces and it made you hit it right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's interesting. And as you start to explain these concepts to people and then know, they're like, now that makes sense. And the industry articulates mass as a collision force, right? When they talk about drivers, you know, they like, well, we put the weight in the toe, it creates a gear effect, it does this. But then it's not, you know, it's really about what the table's been set before impact, right? As you take transition forces coming down, now the new slot, all that stuff is all predicated on mass, leverage, that steering force that's happening in the golf club due to leverage. And the industry, you know, when they test drivers, they clamp them in an iron Byron and they hit whack balls with it, you know, and that there's no soft tissue involved. There's no floating to different positions. It's like, yeah, this driver's great when you hit it here. So I think, you know, and I've been in the industry for 25 years or 35 years. And, I never heard anybody talk about a force like this when they articulate. I always interpreted it as mass.
Yeah.
Impact, right? Not changing everything else.
Yeah.
Good. So
yeah, that's pretty, has your brain ever always worked this way? Or is this something that is like when you were 10 years old, were you thinking about this kind of, like, is that just your mind works this way? Or is this a learned kind of thing?
Yeah, no, I mean, I tried to be a player and then I realized that wasn't going to happen. So, and I was always involved in teaching. And then when I started making stuff, you know, I realized, oh, I can make a golf club. And so, yeah. So then when I created the putter fitting system, you know, it was, you know, I had to create a process, you know, because all the low hanging fruit was taken, you know, Calloway, I mean, all those guys took all the low hanging fruit. And so I said, wow, I could take that concept of the golfing machine and my knowledge that I learned from Henry Griffiths when I was with them, how to build a golf club correctly, and then look at all the components and variations and have it be, create something that could create a process. Then it's kind of that modality of thinking, you know, creates a different space, right? Where if you live in that all the time, then you're just thinking of, you know, how does it work for this person? And how will it work for this person? And how do I train people to do it? And so that's kind of how my brain's evolved. I don't think I mean, I had that tinkers, you know, I used to work on my bike and take it apart and, you know.
Yeah.
Do all that stuff and fix boat motors and things like that. And, but until you focus, I think anybody has the skill if they just focus it, their energy towards it. Like you, the guitar behind you, that didn't play itself, right? You had to figure out how to make noise out of it. And it's not the noise, it's the gaps between the noise. Right. And so it's the same thing. It's just, you know, concerted effort at the same thing all the time. I don't think a whole lot other than trying to make a great golf club every day, you know, or make something cool, you know?
Whatever. Yeah. Yeah. Because you've made your own watches.
I made watches, fly reels, knives. I do all kinds of stuff. There's nothing I don't really feel I could make if I didn't put my mind to it.
Yeah.
So, yeah. And I have the machinery to do it, which is cool. So it's an extension of my thought, and make stuff happen.
Man, yeah. You're an impressive human. Well, I gotta tell you.
For golf, yeah, I don't know about the other part of it. I enjoy making things. I enjoy, you know, like I said, the space is left open because, you know, everybody's trying to sell a widget at a certain price and I'm trying to fit people for a golf club. And
it's pretty interesting that it never even occurred. Like when I saw the pictures of the new wedge and read the, you know, the information on it and the data and all that kind of stuff, like it didn't even occur to me that you could do that to a wedge. And that's what, to me, was just like the most impressive point. And that's what like jumped out, like, well, this is going to change things for sure, because something like that you never even thought of doing, there it is.
Yeah. And the interesting thing is, you know, people think, oh, you're putting 8 grams out on the toe and 2 dummy weights in the center and heel. That's going to move the CG. And we were astounded to see that it moved the CG like a hair.
Yeah.
So right. It's not a CG scenario. And I've been chasing CG for a long time, thinking that, you know, it made sense, you know, put the center of gravity in the middle of the golf club so that when you hit it, it wouldn't twist. But when you start to look at the human condition and what their requirements are, that whole narrative went out the window. And everybody is now chasing CG, I think, a lot in part due to a lot of the dialogue that we created years ago about center of gravity and wedges and things like that. And it can be hurtful.
Yeah.
You know, and in a negative way, having that there. You know, so it's interesting to see us come full circle. And have something like this that we can present and proof's in the pudding. Everybody, there is a setting that's your optimal setting. So,
right.
You know.
Yeah. I was talking to our pal, Chris, about the release. And since I get to talk to you the day before, how will you sort of like, will you sleep tonight? I know you've been doing this for a long time. Like how do you prepare for tomorrow? For launch day?
Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, it'll trundle, you know, it'll build steam. I think, you know, like anything, a new concept, people will go, huh, I don't know about that. I think that's maybe BS, until they actually try it, you know? And so I think, you know, we're small enough to where our splash isn't going to be what a TaylorMade or Callaway splash would be. So it'll, you know, with your help and everybody else that's involved, you know, we're going to get this out and have people understand it. It'll take time. But the people won't really quite understand it until they hit it. And, you know, they'll hopefully trust the reliable sources that say, this is really amazing. And this is, it works. And they'll go, I got to get this wedge, you know, I can get this and it's flexible and I can change the weights myself. And we'll have a wedge optimizer that allow people to make better decisions on their grinds based on questions and certain measurements and scenarios.
Yeah.
That will allow people to make a good estimation of what their grind should be. And then, you know, shaft weight is based on length of swing. You know, so if you have a short backswing, you're not going to, very seldom, almost never does anybody with a short backswing get into a heavy dynamic gold kind of a shaft, you know, because they don't have time to accelerate the golf club. And so the longer the swing gets, the gram weight flows with the length of their swing. So short back swings will have 85 to 95 grams. You know, middle length back swings will be 95 to 110, and then longer swings will be 115 to 130.
Yeah.
So, and then how hard you hit it, you know, determines the amplitude, determines inside that interval, determines the flex. So,
right.
Well, there's easy things to understand just by how long's your back swing? Short. Okay. Well, you should probably be in this shaft.
And, yeah.
You know, and pretty much they buy off the rack shafts and they're all dynamic bolts or, you know, KBS tour shafts or something that's heavier and doesn't match what they actually need. So,
yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Now let's go back. You had mentioned you've been doing this kind of stuff for 35 years, but when did your golf love, your golf career really take off? When did it happen?
Yeah. So my dad grew up in Monterey, Carmel.
Okay.
And, you know, he caddied at Cypress and Pebble and played college golf. He was a very good player. And then we lived in San Jose. And so I went to see my grandparents. They lived on the seventh hole of Carmel Valley Country Club, which is now called Coyle Lodge. Wow. And I would go out and hit balls out in the fairway when I was just a little guy in the evening and got to play a little. But I didn't really – then we moved to Oregon when I was 10, and I got into all the other stuff, you know, football, basketball, baseball, track.
Sure.
And so – and then my freshman year in high school, I broke my arm. I had three surgeries on my arm, and I couldn't play football or basketball anymore. And
how did you break – how did you break your arm?
Well, I was messing around pole vaulting, and I landed, I was doing flips, you know, in the air and landed in the pit. And I landed on my arm funny and I dislocated my elbow and broke a growth plate. And I had to have screws put in my elbow. And so then that summer I went to visit my grandparents and I went out in the evening and started hitting balls into the green. And then I would play a few holes around the house there. And I remember hitting this 3-wood on this long par 3 and I just flushed it and I went, wow, I want to play golf. So I came home and I said, Dad, I play golf. And he goes, you want to play? I've been wanting to play too. It's been so long. And so we joined our little 9-hole country club there in Oregon Coast in Reedsport, Forest Hills Country Club. And I got the bug and I that's all I wanted to do. My grandfather sent me up all these golf clubs that he found on the golf course. And I didn't have one club that matched, and this old bag. And I'm out playing high school golf with just garbage golf equipment on the JV team. And I went from the worst guy on the team to the next year, I was number one man and on the team and varsity. And I played very well in state. And I just was like, man, I want to be a golf pro. So I've had my sights on being a golf pro since I was 15.
Wow.
And just loved it. I mean, I worked mowing greens, working on the greens crew, working in the pro shop. And then subsequently in college, I went to same thing. I mowed greens in the morning. I put my way through college, so my parents at the time couldn't afford to help. So wow. I worked in pro shops. And then I worked at a place called Fiddler's Green, which was the largest discount golf or largest on-course golf shop in the world. It was like 15,000 square feet of golf retail merchandise. And I worked there and learned how to fit and understand golf equipment. And, you know, I was a total gearhead. And it was the same place Ari Techner started Scratch out of, was Fiddler.
Is that right?
Yeah.
So, that's awesome.
Yeah. So, it was a cool place. The Whalens, man, they had Al Whalen, man, that guy was a club collector and really great family and, you know, instilled in me that love for golf. I had a great head pro at my little 9-hole golf course, Jeff Rosenau. And that guy was the funniest, coolest guy. And, you know, I said, man, this is how you're supposed to be, you know, this is what golf pros are like, man, this is cool. And, and then I got into teaching and I found the golfing machine and that propelled my career. And through Ben Doyle, I met Chuck Cook, and Chuck Cook gave me a job to teach in South America. And
How long did you do the South America gig?
Yeah, I started in 92 and to about 96.
Wow.
Lived in Argentina and Chile and went through Central and South America, Northern South America, learned to speak Spanish fluently. And Yeah, it was a trip, man. I go down there for, you know, 5 months, make a boatload of money, come back up, go to Coeur d'Alene, Idaho, teach up there, and just follow the sun. You know, I didn't have a care in the world, but teaching golf and having a good time.
Learning. So why aren't you still doing that? At what point you're like, I want to build and I want to make a company. I want to start a company.
Yeah, no, it's a hard business, you know, teaching and traveling, and you can only sell your time. And, you know, I realized at some point in time that it would burn me out, and I was getting burnt out. And my family, we owned some hotels on the Oregon coast at that time. And, you know, they said, well, why don't you come join us? We're building another hotel and you can run these two. And so I said, yeah, that sounds like a great idea. I'm going to have a baby and can't be traveling all over the world. So I joined the family business and running hotels, and I hated it. I grew up in that. My family had a fishing resort. So I grew up, you know, in that hospitality industry. And it wasn't for me, you know, I missed. So I said, well, I'm going to do something I love. And that, so I started making golf clothes because I started making belt buckles. I got into those really cool three-piece Ranger buckles that everybody was wearing at the time. And so I started making those. And I go, I can make a golf club. And so I whittled out a wax, a putter head that looked like a pinata kind of. And I had a foundry guy in my town, and we poured it in silver. And my first putter was made out of pure silver.
Come on.
And then I ended up meeting Bobby Grace, and I said, what would you make a putter out of if you could? And he said, well, stainless steel, it's just so expensive. So I said, I'm going to make stainless steel putters. So I found a local machinist, and we made some, 10 putters and sold them to my friends at a loss. And then I just started. Then I started making putters for Henry Griffiths. We created a process called Fit to Aim.
Mm-hmm.
And I designed heads for that. And I came up with a line template that would allow us to not have so many combinations of heads, because they all had to have a fixed line on them. And so I created this line template with a wet erase marker. You could draw lines on the putter and reduce the inventory from, you know, 30 putters in the system to 4 and, or 5. And then they didn't want to continue with it. And I kept going, hey, let's do this, let's do that. And they're like, Dave, just do your own thing and, you know, knock yourself out. We're not going to probably keep this alive. Okay, cool. And so my first account was Chuck Cook, and I hired a machinist and bought CNC machine and went that route. And, just never looked back.
Where's the pure silver putter today?
It's sitting over there in my, I got a little rack with all my original first stuff articles. I never sell
really
putter. Yeah. I keep all my first stuff.
And, that's awesome.
It's, you'd look at it and go, which was my first putter? And it's kind of like, you know, in the Indiana Jones, when they're looking at the Holy Grail, right? And they're all grabbing the fancy jug, and it's the old wooden one over there.
So, right. Right.
It's pretty hideous, but you know, somewhere.
Now, how have you as a designer sort of evolved? And as a, like, you know, has from that first hideous pure silver putter to the stuff you're making today?
Yeah. So I look at putter heads. I don't try to create a shape for an industrial design sake, you know, to be cool looking and, you know, try to sell a putter based on it.
Yeah.
Looks. I come to the understanding that shapes produce and elicit a response. They elicit a perception. And so every head style that I have is based on the need for the fitting process, that you know, this head will do this, this head will do that, this head will do this. And then there's necks that match, you know, you have a neck system so that you're controlling offset and then lines and scenarios like that. So I don't look at it in a way that I'm trying to sell something that looks cool. I mean, obviously I try to make it look cool.
Right.
You know, then you have to manufacture it, and you have to, you know, you can't create all these weird bevels and angles and then grab it in a vise. You know, if anybody has a watermelon seed, that's, if you put, have a half a degree or degree difference in an angle, it'll squirt out of a machine vise, right? You can't hold it without fixturing it And so everything I've created has been probably a little more industrial looking in the past, just to be able to machine it, manufacture. You know, my first fitting system had almost 800 million permutations in it. So, you know, and that's line, that's weight and all shaft lengths and different shafts and heads and line combinations and faces and lofts and all that stuff. So, you know, you have to be able to manufacture every one of those to the gnat's ass, because that's what the process has to be. It has to,
sure,
you know, putter was this, it's, you fit into that, and that's the one that you fit into. That's what we manufactured. So it's always been based around, you know, the function of aim and the function of controlling weight,
mm-hmm,
and for the purpose of fitting people into the right putter. You know, and then I like making, you know, the 009 or answered looking putters and, you know, TP Mills replica stuff. You know, I'm a big fan of historical stuff. So I like doing that as a fun scenario. And, you know, but that business has kind of disappeared. I think people are more into function and less into blinged out $5,000 putters, you know.
Yeah, it seems that way, right?
Yeah, it's, people are, you know, it's, that cool factor's kind of wore off, you know, oh, I got this and you don't, you know.
Right. Yeah. I also feel like there's a want, at least in my little circle, there's a want to kind of revisit the older equipment, yeah, but have the modern technology built into it a little bit more.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know, having golf clubs with big old badges on them and all this techie looking stuff, it's kind of like people like that just traditional looking iron again, you know, but
yeah,
want the performance characteristics of what the new age has created. But, you know, there's a lot of funky stuff going on with, you know, irons, you know, putting numbers on golf clubs that aren't the number that the loft is. You know, I grew up,
yeah,
you know, pitching wedge was 48 degrees. Now it's, you know, now they're 42, you know,
and right,
it's, you know, we measure golf clubs when they come in the shop and I'm just like, that's not a 8 iron. That's a, it's like a weak 6 iron.
You know? Right.
Like, and there's weird gaps and hot faces that, you know, that's why a lot,
yeah,
of tour players can't play that stuff, because they get a flyer out of something, you know, and go, what,
sure,
did that 10 yards farther than I wanted to. So yeah, it's, you know, we're all chasing distance, but you know, it's loft's loft. We got to have, right, caps, you know, it's just, and you know, we're not in that mindset of, hey, let's just trinkle out the next best, you know, version of, you know, a laundry detergent every year, you know,
right,
improve, right? It's like,
right,
put good concepts in it from the get-go, and then, you know, that golf club line can last for 5 years. You know, my wedge line lasted for 9, almost 10 years.
Yeah.
You know, so yeah. I don't, you know, apart from finishes and different this and that or grinds, you know, the concept won't go away, just like the putter fitting concept didn't go away for 25 years. So, yeah, just do quality stuff and put it out. And so we're, you know, we're looking towards other things. Probably won't ever get into woods, but I won't say that just because that's a pretty hard market, you know?
Yeah.
But if something comes up that you go, wow, this is transformative to the wood industry, you know, we'd be more than happy to do it. But we look at ourselves as a scoring company, you know, from irons on into the green, you know,
I like it.
I'd like to, yeah, be someone's best option for that. You know, when they come and say, wow, it's a vertically integrated process between the education, the product and the fitting, to where I can get what I need from a Dell Golf and it works and it's cool and it's has sex appeal. And it's made for me, which makes it even more important. In the
car. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I've always appreciated about the, don't get me wrong, like I'll play the big boy stuff, you know, but I always appreciate and there's almost an inherent trust with the smaller company because you guys aren't, you know, on any sort of release schedule or demand for a release schedule. And I feel like you guys release things when you're damn good and ready to release it, uh-huh, and not before.
Yeah.
Right.
Oh, and you know, and that's, and you know, we're not having to please investors, you know, that's
sure,
the big things, you know, I remember I was looked at by one of the two of the big OEMs looked at me back in the day, and they, I always got shut down by marketing because marketing's like, we're not trying to sell them one putter. We're trying to sell them a lot of putters, you know. They get that putter, they're going to keep it for 5 years, you know. And it's like, that's not our business model, you know. So I realized, wow, their need is to sell equipment and keep investors happy, and ours is to make the golfers happy, right? And if we do that, we should be able to make money, you know, and be a successful business. And, you know, so it's a total, it's on the polar opposite of just selling something to sell it, you know. And and I'm not saying that they're not trying to make a good golf club and trying to make people better golfers, but it really is about selling units, you know, and squashing people that are in their way to sell units, you know, to get in their way of them selling units. So, and which I get, I mean, it's a dog eat dog world out there, but you know, in the space I'm at, they don't want to go, you know, it's too damn hard. It's hard, you know, you got to train people, you got to educate people. And, but in the end, That's what the customer wants, right? They don't want to be an outlier, and they want to be recognized. And that's our niche.
Yeah. And if you love the way that you do what you do and where you are, and then keep doing that.
Yeah. Yeah. And right? You know, I don't need to be a $1 billion company, you know, I have to just be a really good, solid company that, you know, year after year, just keeps outperforming itself and grows at a pace that, you know, we can grow at. And, you know, something crazy could happen. You know, you get that player that does and goes and wins a U.S. Open or a Masters or something with your product, and you can't really control the demand. You know, like when Nicklaus won with that response putter, he had like, you know, 500,000 orders in months. You know, it's like, wow, you know. So, you know, it's just kind of play by ear and just keep doing what we think is the right thing to do. And it'll all wash out.
So, one last question, I guess, and then I'll send you on your way to prepare for the big release. I assume you're having just a massive release party of some kind.
No. We already know what it is. So, we're just hopeful that it'll be a big splash and people will be going, wow. Cool.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Can't wait to get these. How do I get it? You know, kind of a thing. So,
yeah. So what was your, you may not want to answer this. I don't know. We'll see. The worst idea you've ever had when designing a piece of equipment, something that you're like, I think this is going to be good. And then when you got done with it, you're like, this is a huge mistake. Have you ever had one of those moments?
No, really. You know, because I vet it pretty hard before I launch anything or create anything. You know, I'd say maybe the biggest mistake that I made would have been, you know, throwing down so hard on single length.
Okay.
Only because of what it cost us and what it did to us financially, you know. I expected people to have a greater interest in the category, and I knew it was going to take a long time, but I thought it would have had a lot greater impact in the
industry. Yeah,
and we're starting to see it now, you know.
We're
getting a lot of interest now, and Bryson helps, you know. When Bryson plays well, people see it and it makes sense. And it's not going to be until we see other, you know, because he has a different technique. And so people are assimilating, oh, I got to swing like Bryson to make single length work. And you know, then, you know, other companies have had single length out also. And it's not until, and our option was so much more expensive. So it was kind of a barrier for people to experiment. You're in or you're not. So I'd say that was probably my biggest mistake that I've ever made, is putting so many eggs in one basket, believing that it was going to take off. And I know it's not going to go anywhere. It's just going to take more time, you know, for people to have enough experience with it to, have it be viable.
I feel like you were the, you know, that scene in Back to the Future where Michael J. Fox plays the Chuck Berry song and the whole audience kinds of like, they kind of freak out and don't know what to do. Yeah. Like that was you with the long eye, like with the single length. Like your kids are going to love it. They're not ready.
That's preachy. You know? It's like, right. Oh God, it's terrible. You know, and he's like, this is going to be really cool one day.
Right.
Yeah. So, I mean, that really happened with me with, you know, butter fitting. You know, I thought, wow, why don't people, why doesn't this matter to people, you know? And now that the industry came to us, more so than, you know, I've always been there going, hey, I've been here forever, you know, doing this.
Right.
And now it makes more sense, you know, but yeah, the old processes have been in place for so long that it's pretty hard to buck the system until, and now, you know, we know now through anything, whether you want a pair of jeans or whatever, you don't go buy Levi's or something like that. You go look for this really cool off brand. You know, that's what people want to go, what are you wearing there? And, you know, it's like, oh, I got blah, blah, blah. And they're like, wow, that's cool. And so this hipster kind of culture that we have now is, you know, brands don't matter. It's like, it's got to meet the needs of what they want and, you know, being unique and well-made. And, you know, so it's kind of, that's where we're going, I think, with things. It's not so much about the big brands anymore. It's about, you know, individuality of what's going on. And
yeah, for sure.
I
feel like the internet has really helped your like companies like yours to establish a personality. And then I, as a golfer who want my own sort of personality, can go and find, you know, your stuff and be like, yeah, this is,
yeah,
I'm unique because I have unique stuff now.
Yeah. I mean, you know, that's it. You know, the whole thing has opened up, you know, people like you look towards, you know, they don't want to talk about the same thing everybody else is talking about, right? They want to say, hey, there's these cool people out there that do all this really cool stuff, whether it's a head cover maker or somebody doing something totally unique in golf. That's the story, you know, and, you know, the attrition that happened over from 2007, you know, with the crash. Financial crash and what it did to golf and the big brands consolidating things, you know, kind of opened up a little window for these small companies. And it's hard to survive as a small company. You know, I always went and talked to these small guys and they would go like, oh man, you're so much farther along and it's cool. And I'm like, man, we're not at odds. You know, you can always call me and talk to me. You know, we're all just trying to take a little piece of what they got, you know, and
right.
I'm not afraid of you, you know? And I have no animosity towards any of the small guys. It's like, you know, we're in the same battle together. We're doing the same thing. And there's, we're just trying to get our own little piece of the pie and do what we love doing. And I think it's really important for people to support good small companies, you know? If not, you know, you're going to get the same kind of scenarios from the top down. And
right,
you know, innovation comes from, you know, some dude in a garage, you know.
Right. And right.
There's a lot of smart
that's right
there, and there's a lot of craftsmen out there, and you know, we're all doing what we love doing, so it's making it fun. I wake up every
or in your case, it comes from you know, experimenting with rolled up pieces of lead tape on a March or April random day.
Yeah, and it changed my life. I know it's changed. You know, from that moment forward, I knew that, man, this is different. This is going to be cool. So, and others, you know, will rip off and duplicate, which is called R&D. and, you know, everybody will steal something from it. And I know that'll happen. You know, it's pretty hard to patent putting weights in a golf club that's been done
right
before. So just being first to market and being the one that's, you know, creating new terminology, new processes to show how this works is, I think, our niche. And,
hopefully
people recognize that we were the first to do so many things in the wedge, you know, moving the grooves out. We were the first company to do that. We first to do a lot of trail and heel cuts, toe and heel cuts and trail cuts, you know, shorten the hosel, all that stuff, you know, and subsequently wedges started looking like our wedges. Right. And,
right.
And, you know, single length and interchangeable weight on a golf club and, you know, understanding lines and head shapes for putting and, you know, the concept of fitting. is out there. So, you know, I think we've been pretty fortunate to keep coming up with some good ideas all the time.
Yeah. Well, I'm excited for tomorrow.
Yeah.
I'm excited for the release. I can't wait for people to see this stuff. Genuinely. It's, again, I'd mentioned before, I know you're right. People are going to go and take your idea and do things with it. Right. Mm-hmm. But you're the timestamp. You are the marker, in the golf timeline that said, this is that day that this happened. And now everyone else from that point on is going to do that. You're John Bonham playing drums, right? Like from that point on, that's it.
Yep. Like 4:10 beat. That's right. Ginger Baker. Yeah. So yeah, it's fun. And I hope I had some more ideas, you know, you look at something and you're like, God, what's the next one going to be? You know, cause if you can't really change something or create something unique, it's kind of, you go, God, dude, am I going to come up with any good ideas from here on out? You know, but I think, you know, it's really going to come down to integration in the future. You know, having groundbreaking technology like the Big Bertha driver coming out, that was a timestamp, you know, and coming out with face flex technology and irons and things like that. Those are all big game changers in how a golf club got built. But, you know, having the integration of it all, that's where it's going to come down in the future. It's going to somebody and knowing that they can fit you, they can build a golf club for you, they can teach you. And it's all based around what they need. There's no conforming. Sorry, there's a card. but yeah, so I think that's a lot of where my mind is going is in the integration of the processes and putting it together in the most, you know, rather than outsourcing a teacher teaching someone and someone outsourcing their equipment and, you know, and there's a disconnect between that, you know, when the team might say, well, I wouldn't have bought that shaft or I wouldn't have done that. And, you know, so it's really going to come down to, I think, integration in the future of concepts and putting a whole bunch of really good stuff together for that individual in one package. That's what you want, right?
Yeah.
You got when you go to the doctor, right? You know,
sure.
I got this going on, and okay, we got our specialist over here. We can go here, and then we can go chop you open over here, and we trust that process because it's, you know, it matters, and I think people will say this matters to me, and I don't want to waste my money on an incomplete scenario.
Yeah,
I want the right things for me, and I want to go to the people that know the right things, and
right.
So I think our network is as important as the golf equipment we make, you know, is people going and feeling like they got what they deserve to get. So,
yeah. All right, man, this is fun. Boy, I could listen to you talk about this kind of stuff all day. Honest to God, it's fascinating. I'm here. It's really great. I really appreciate it.
No, I appreciate it, Chris.
Have you gone back to the little 9-hole, you know, country club where it all started in Oregon?
Yeah, I was back there. My brother passed away, and I went down there and drove by my old shop, my little building that I built that was 25x30 where I started at Del Golf. I look in that building and I go, how did I have 3 CNC machines in there, 2 knee mills, a lathe, big table, all this other stuff, chop saws. And I'm like, it was like working in a submarine, but it was my place, you know, I knew where everything was. It was awesome. I go back there and they people ask me, are you still working at Fiddler's Green? You know, that was like 20-30 years ago. What are you talking about? I don't think I sold a putter in my hometown. The Beatles were never successful in Liverpool.
That's right.
Successful in the States, you know.
So. All right, sir. I'll let you go. Thank you so much for this.
I appreciate it.
So that is David Adell, just a brilliant, brilliant human being. But even more impressive to me, like, it's one thing to be super, super smart, right? And that's great. But it's kind of worthless if you can't relate to, you know, people like me the normal human beings of the golf world, of the world in general. And I was just really impressed even more so that he is just like, he's just a guy, you know, that loves golf, and he has this brilliant mind, and he applies it to golf equipment design. And I thank him for that. We should thank him for that. He's making the game better and easier and more fun through the stuff that he creates in his head, basically. I find it just fascinating that this new wedge that I think, again, will be so significant to the game of golf was sort of just a happy accident. Just awesome. And David and I hung out after we stopped recording for probably a good half hour and just kind of, you know, shot the shit a little bit, kind of hung out. And he's got a lot of great ideas, a lot of really great plans. He's got some amazing memorabilia besides his old putter that's made out of silver, but some really, really significant stuff. And he's got some great ideas and some great plans. And I hope, David, if you're listening, please hurry, because I want to experience a lot of it. I want to see it happen selfishly. But that's the show. You know, matter of fact, I should say that my pal Bill Bush, co-host of That Range Life, the YouTube show we do every week, he's got some of these wedges. And so he will be reporting back to us on how they perform very soon. So head over to YouTube. You can find me at Chris McEwen there. Subscribe to that channel and stay tuned. I'm very excited to hear about how they work, how they play, because I think the idea behind them, the theory behind them, is just amazing. Anyways, that's the show, everybody. Thanks for listening. Enjoy Masters Week. It's spring. It's the Masters. And it's kind of like the best time of year for the golf crazies like us. So enjoy it. I'll be watching and, you know, watching along and commenting on Twitter and all those sorts of things. So if you want to jump in and join me on there, it's at Chris McEwen. I am also on Instagram at Chris McEwen. And I'm doing some stuff on Facebook at Chris McEwen Golf, if you're a Facebook person, and you can find me on there as well. Otherwise, I will leave you with, let's get back into Led Zeppelin, right? Good times, bad times. And I think we'll come right back in on Jimmy Page just introducing himself with one of the most amazing guitar solos that you'll ever hear, right? Okay. Everyone have a good week, and I will talk to you next week.